you. Being with us out of Madison, Emeritus Professor from the University of Wisconsin, Frank Inspach, and out of Budapest, Senior Research Fellow, Global Policy Institute, George Zamute. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing off for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
We draw your attention to verses 54 and 55 of chapter Araf from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Inna رَبَّكُمُ اللَّهُ الَّذِي خَلَقَ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضَ فِي سِتَّةِ أَيَّامٍ خَلَقَ السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام ثم استوى على العرش ثم استوى على العرش يغشي الليل النهار يطلبه حثيثا والشمس والقمر والنجوم مسخرات بأمره ألا له الخلق والأمر تبارك الله رب العالمين ادعوا لَعَلَّكُمْ تَضَرَّعُونَ وَخُفْيَةً إِنَّهُ لَا يُحِبُّ الْمُعْتَدِينَ صَدَقَ اللَّهُ الْعَلِيُّ الْعَظِيمُ.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Surely, your Lord is Allah, who created the heavens and the earth in six periods of time, and He is firm in power. He throws the veil of night over the day, which it pursues incessantly, and He created the sun and the moon and the stars, made subservient by His command. Surely, His is the creation and the command. Blessed is Allah, the Lord of the worlds. Call on your Lord humbly and secretly. Surely, He does not love those who exceed the limits.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
This hour's headlines. Myanmar's army detains the country's de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi and other senior officials amid tensions following the November elections. Police in Belgium and Austria make scores of arrests as thousands of people rally to protest COVID-19 restrictions and lockdowns. And hundreds of Palestinian inmates held in Israeli jails have been diagnosed with the COVID-19. We'll have a report from Ramallah. And those were the top stories of welcome. Myanmar's army says the country's leader Aung San Suu Kyi and other senior figures have been detained in response to alleged fraud during last year's general elections. The military declared 1 year state of emergency and said power has now been handed to the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. The coup d'etat comes after days of escalating tensions between the government and the country's powerful military. The army had called on the government to postpone convening of a new parliament. Military leaders claim the last parliamentary elections were fraudulent. Muang Zarni, a Burmese academic in exile, says the military coup in Myanmar was not out of expectation, as it is still a fragile democracy, largely controlled by generals.
This is expected, primarily because we have had in the last 10 years a situation where Western governments and UN and pretty much the whole world accepted this farce or farcical perception that Myanmar is a fragile democracy, transition is fragile under Aung San Suu Kyi, so don't rock the boat. But the fact is, Myanmar is still very much controlled by the military, and that military has adopted a constitution which they wrote themselves, and they adopted it, and the constitution legalizes military coup.
International reactions are pouring in over the detention of Myanmar's de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi and other political figures during an army coup. A spokesman for the UN chief said Antonio Guterres has strongly condemned the detentions and urged Myanmar's military to respect the will of the people. Stéphane Dujarric called the developments in the Southeast Asian nation a serious blow to democratic reforms. The United States has called for the immediate release of detained officials, warning the Myanmarese military of response from Washington. Australia, Japan, and Indonesia also reacted and called for a lawful and peaceful resolution to the crisis. Myanmar's Rohingya Muslims, who have taken refuge in neighboring Bangladesh, slammed the coup and called for international assistance for the restoration of democracy. In other news, Belgians have staged protest rallies in the capital, Brussels, to express their discontent with government-imposed lockdown measures.
Liberté de manifester! Liberté de manifester!
The demonstrators defied a ban on gatherings and marched through several districts. Minor scuffles also broke out between police and the protesters. Police officials said more than 200 people were arrested during the rallies. In October, the government placed a nighttime curfew and restrictions on public places in an attempt to stem the spread of the coronavirus. The demonstrators called for the immediate lifting of all bans.
I'm here because I think it is not right at all what is going on, just because of a virus that doesn't kill that many people. Now, people are dying, starving. They can't work and earn money, so I don't find that normal.
Anger prevails in several other European countries against coronavirus-related lockdowns and restrictions. Polish police raided public places that defied restrictions while violent protests erupted in the Dutch capital with police clashing with demonstrators. Europe is bracing for a new wave of infections in the coming months. France has already closed its borders to non-European countries, whereas Germany has barred travelers from countries battling with new COVID variants. A two-week ban on foreign travel also took effect in Portugal on Sunday. Well, in a similar development, thousands of Austrians have taken to the streets of Vienna to protest COVID-19 restrictions and lockdowns. The demonstration was held without police permission, leading to numerous arrests. Homa Lesgi reports.
An estimated 5,000 people take part in another massive demonstration in Vienna against COVID restrictions, this time without police permission.
Police had banned all major demonstrations planned for the weekend across the federal capital. Meanwhile, the Archdiocese of Vienna had warned of a corona demonstration disguised as a Christian procession.
Police forces reported numerous arrests as demonstrators defied calls to disperse, to keep the required distance, and to wear face masks. Protesters called the government-imposed lockdown dictatorial and argued it wouldn't work in stopping the virus's spread.
I want to live in peace with everyone. I want to work. We want to enjoy our life that is given from God.
So the people are going crazy, people have to work. If you don't die from virus, you die from hunger. Because the people have no money, everything is closed, it's crazy.
The Sunday rally had been proposed by the right-wing opposition Freedom Party, the FPÖ. The demonstration was among 15 banned by authorities to avoid any major danger to public health. And although party leaders called for compliance, their supporters still turned up. Local media also reported the presence of far-right and neo-Nazi groups. The ruling party said the FPÖ had reached a new low by embracing right-wing extremists and coronavirus deniers. Austria's third hard lockdown is expected to end on the 7th of February. And while trade unions warn of mass bankruptcy if the country doesn't reopen, virologists say the current number of infections is still too high. Authorities are counting on further vaccination and a test, trace and isolate policy to keep the situation under control. Homa Lesgi, Vienna.
Now, dozens of Palestinian inmates have been diagnosed with COVID-19 while held in Israeli jails. This comes as the regime refuses to respect basic human rights and provide them with medical care. Earlier, we discussed that issue in detail with our guests in our news review program.
At least hundreds of Palestinian inmates in Israeli jails have tested positive for coronavirus. This comes amid Israel's defiance against international calls to respect the basic rights of Palestinians and provide them with medical care during the pandemic. Mona Kandil reports from the West Bank.
With Israel's failure to contain the spread of coronavirus in Israel and the Palestinian-occupied territories, at least 200 Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails tested positive in January, bringing the total number of Palestinian prisoners who have been infected with the coronavirus to more than 350, according to Palestinian Prisoners Affairs Commission. The commission accused the Israeli Prison Administration of depriving the Palestinian inmates of medical care. The commission also said the increase of cases among the Israeli soldiers was the first source of a transmission of the virus to the Palestinian prisoners.
We are following with great concern the spread of the virus among the Palestinian prisoners. We hold Israel accountable for the health of the Palestinian inmates. Israel must respect international law.
During a protest held in support of the Palestinian prisoners in the occupied city of Ramallah, Palestinian officials and prisoner rights groups called on the international bodies to intervene and put an end to the medical negligence practiced by the Israeli Prison Administration against Palestinian prisoners. They say Israel must vaccinate the estimated 4,500 Palestinians held in its jails against COVID-19.
Today, the international community must step in and save the lives of our Palestinian inmates. Israel must be held accountable for its crimes and policies towards prisoners. This should be done through global pressure on Israel.
Israel has already begun to vaccinate its population. This comes as the regime denies Palestinians in the occupied lands of the vaccine. International rights groups have slammed Israel for the move, calling on it to remain faithful to its commitments under international treaties. Under the Geneva Conventions, Israel must provide vaccines not only to prisoners held in its jails, but also to those living under its occupation in the West Bank and also in the besieged Gaza Strip. This definitely is raising political and public health questions about Israel's responsibilities to the Palestinians as an occupying regime. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
And to discuss that further, we're joined by Imad Hamad. He's the executive director at the American Human Rights Council from Michigan, and also Mick Napier from the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign. Gentlemen, welcome. Imad, if I can start with you. So 350 Palestinian prisoners now infected with COVID-19. What's your thoughts on that? Israel stands accused of depriving the Palestinians of their medical care.
Well, this is another tragic, traumatic, discriminatory racist measures taken by the state of Israel. The root of the problem here is the nature and the identity of Israel as a racist state. So it's not limited to deprive Palestinian prisoners from this basic human right of receiving the vaccine equal to any other human living in the occupied territories. It's not fair at all that Israel managed to vaccine close to 2 million of its residents, and Palestinians at large, including prisoners, barely have any attention whatsoever. This is another crime against humanity, and right. Being selective here and being discriminatory here is not only illegal, it goes back to the core aspect and the identity of Israel and what Israel stands for, simply a racist state.
Right. Mick, Palestinians are not getting the vaccines. Israelis are, and Israelis say that the Palestinians should take care of their own health problems. Is that the case?
That's not true.
Pardon me, Imad, that's for Mick.
It's not only preposterous, but anyone can realize that this is disgusting and cynical, because Palestinians under the PA in the West Bank, they cannot move a box of pills without Israeli military permission. I spoke to someone from the public health committees in Gaza 2 weeks ago, and she told me, I asked her the number of vaccines which had reached Gaza, and she said the number was zero. And despite the Herculean efforts of a tremendous medical cadre there, doctors, nurses, and pharmacists, and everyone else. The simple fact is the conditions of life are such that they cannot deliver effective protection to the people of Gaza. The prisoners are another case in point. There's no doubt that Israel has a duty of care. It is the occupying power. But, you know, this is a government which has been shown to practice systematic torture against Palestinian political prisoners, which is known to practice medical neglect so that prisoners from time to time are released in order to die a short time later. I think there's a major difference. I'm speaking to you from a country where we have 100,000 dead because of coronavirus. And criticisms of the government are incompetence, even criminal incompetence. But it's different in Israel. It's the deliberate use of a medical pandemic in order to intensify suffering and pain on the Palestinian people. And this fits into the full spectrum of Israeli policies. How could we expect Israel, found by the United Nations Human Rights Commission, to be deliberately killing Palestinian children, to be maiming thousands and thousands of Palestinians deliberately? How can we expect them to be the epitome of viciousness in one area and to be benign in the other? It's not possible. Right. So this is the full spectrum of horror, and the Israelis are using the vaccine, are using the pandemic to inflict even greater suffering on the Palestinians.
Okay, gentlemen, thank you very much indeed. I'm afraid we have run out of time. Let me thank our guests, Imad Hamad, the Executive Director at the American Human Rights Council, and Mick Napier, as always, from the Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign. Gentlemen, thank you very much indeed, and thank you for staying tuned to this edition of The News Review.
The New York mayor has acknowledged the presence of racial disparities in terms of who is receiving COVID-19 vaccines in the U.S. city. Bill de Blasio said Black and Latino residents are taking jabs at a much lower rate compared to white or Asian New Yorkers. The mayor placed the blame on a combination of distrust in the vaccine among minority communities and greater ease of access to the shots for white New Yorkers. He vowed to offer people better opportunities to get the vaccines, particularly in communities of color. His comments come as data shows the coronavirus pandemic has killed Black and Latino residents at remarkably higher rates in not only the city, but across the entire country. Colin Campbell says the issue of racial disparity in the U.S. has roots in the country's history.
When you have something that has happened generationally and you have a new introduction of a virus or a pandemic or whatever it could be, those disparities that have existed for generations are going to continue. When you look at the state of New York, and there are about 300,000 people who have received the vaccine, 48% of them being white, it really shows that this disparity does continue. And even some of the most diverse, most metropolitan cities in our country. And this will continue to happen too until there are some fundamental things that need to be addressed. When you look at what the governor has talked about or the mayor has talked about, when you have Black communities who are a little bit reluctant to take the vaccine, well, there's history there. There's a historical data discussing the Tuskegee experiment, the disparity in the way that Black people have been treated in hospitals. All of that builds up a level of distrust.
Iran's president says the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution was a global manifestation of the country's social assets. Hassan Rouhani was speaking at the mausoleum of the late founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Khomeini. He said Imam Khomeini toppled the U.S.-backed regime of Mohammad Reza Pahlavi through relying on people's power. Iran is holding 10-day celebrations marking the 42nd anniversary of the triumph of the Islamic Revolution. Every year, Iranians commemorate the occasion by holding ceremonies and events nationwide. A revolution emerged victorious on the 11th of February in 1979. And Russia has accused the European Union of pursuing double standards towards Moscow in the wake of police response to recent protests in the country. Russian First Deputy Permanent Representative to the UN criticized the EU for failing to denounce what he called disproportionate use of force against protesters in the bloc's member states. Dmitry Polyansky said police in Austria, France, and the Netherlands have used brutal force in response to recent protests there. He reacted after EU foreign policy chief Josep Borrell said Russia has resorted to widespread detentions and disproportionate use of force against protesters and journalists. Several Russian cities have witnessed rallies in the past days over the detention of opposition figure Alexei Navalny. Hundreds have been arrested during the demonstrations, which the Kremlin called unauthorized. That's it for me for now.
Diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually, and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need, which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Iwe's tragedy. Part 2.
The US is the only country in the world, apart from Haiti, that has not ratified the Basel Convention, the international agreement banning the export of toxic waste. To make matters worse, the US government itself is as bad as anyone else when it comes to recycling its own discarded equipment.
The US government is the single biggest producer of electronic waste on the planet.
Discarded electronics of whole departments are routinely put out to public auction instead of being sent to trustworthy recyclers.
Whoever gives the government the best rate, in other words, they can take it for free or almost for free, the government is kind of obliged to do that, because in our laws you're supposed to go the cheapest way to save the taxpayer money. But the cheapest way is the dirtiest way.
Recyclers who do actually recycle find themselves the target of shady exporters. Plant manager Craig Lorch has been in the business for more than 20 years.
We get regular requests from brokers that are in other countries looking to buy materials, buying computers, metals, laptops, anything with valuable materials in them. We don't sell to them. We don't know what they're going to do with the materials. We don't know where it's going to go.
Craig is part of a minority of conscientious recyclers who collaborate with Jim Puckett and the Basel Action Network. But many U.S. recyclers do export. The Basel Action Network estimates that between 20 and 50 e-waste containers leave U.S. harbors every day. To find out where exactly U.S. e-waste is exported to, Jim came up with a very effective spying technique.
We will just go around to these people calling themselves recyclers, and you drive by them, and the beauty is that you can't hide a big old 40-foot container.
So it's very easy to photograph them, and they have prominent numbers. And we take pictures of those, and we date them.
Jim then goes online to find out where the e-waste containers are headed.
I can type that number into a database called TrackTrace, and we see the whole record of that particular container in its last week's voyages. It's gone from Thailand to Singapore, now it's in New Zealand.
Analyzing the main trading routes for U.S. e-waste, Jim made a surprising discovery.
It comes through Hong Kong almost 65% of the time from the U.S. We didn't know that till we started tracking and tracking and tracking. Wow, they're all going to Hong Kong.
Hong Kong Harbor is the third largest port in the world, and any e-waste sent by the U.S. to Asia enters through here. But why isn't it seized and returned straight to sender? ...63,000 containers arrive here every single day on merchant ships of all shapes and sizes. Vincent Wong oversees the customs team at the harbor. The biggest terminal, Kwai Sing, receives nearly 50,000 containers a day. Up to 100 of them are estimated to contain e-waste. Tracking them down is a challenge.
Hong Kong is a free port. That means that the ship and the cargo don't have to declare to customs at the point of entry right away, except they are demanded by customs officers. They only need to declare after 14 days, within 14 days of the import or export of a consignment.
This means that by the time Wong and his colleagues receive the customs declaration, the cargo has usually long moved on. To combat this loophole, the customs inspectors pull out any containers which ring an alarm bell. For instance, because of the company's history or a tip-off from abroad, and submit them to an X-ray scan.
We can scan a container truck in less than 2 minutes, the whole truck, and then if necessary, we'll open the container for further inspection.
E-waste has its very own shape and look under an X-ray scanner. Items like computer monitors stand out clearly.
For e-waste, we have quite a number of cases in the past few years, and most of them are declared as plastic scrap or metal scrap.
Up to 36,000 e-waste containers are estimated to enter through Hong Kong Harbour every year, enough to fill 20 of the largest cargo ships. About 40 containers a year are intercepted, sent back, and their owners prosecuted.
We do not process each and every container coming or going out of Hong Kong. Around the world, there's no one customs administration that can process 100% of them.
As a result, there are always containers that escape the authorities. Chinese activists are trying to find out what happens to them.
I always want to do something to make some change. So I joined Greenpeace since 2002. The first campaign is working on the e-waste.
Lai Yun is investigating how the e-waste containers slipping through the controls at Hong Kong get to mainland China. Just north of Hong Kong Island in the New Territories, there is a perfect hiding place for e-waste in transit. Lai Yun has come to pick up the trail.
This area is farmland. I heard about a lot of e-waste from the overseas, like United States, coming to Hong Kong. First, we're stored in this area.
He soon finds a storage yard. Here, the e-waste shipments await transport over the border. And since the storage of e-waste is not illegal, the authorities are turning a blind eye. There are dozens of yards in this area. This site contains everything from TV sets to monitors and computers. If these, as usually claimed on customs declarations, were really exported as usable second-hand goods, they wouldn't be sitting out in the open air in the rain.
I think that China and the United States so important work together to solve the e-waste problem. This is an international issue.
From the storage yards, the e-waste is smuggled across the border into mainland China. It's just a few miles away, but it's illegal.
The trucks reload in new territories and drive across very close, and they have to pay a bribe. It's the only way they could get across. Or you use a small coaster boat and go up the Pearl River Delta into areas like Nanhai. And there, again, you'd pay a bribe to unload it.
Once the e-waste has crossed the border, it travels to places like the town of Guiyu.
When we went to the Guiyu, we don't see any signs to say, okay, this is Guiyu, but we just smell, very strong the smell. Okay, we know we arrived at Guiyu.
Guiyu is one of many Chinese towns and villages where illegal e-waste recycling is happening on an industrial scale. No. 80% of the population are involved, processing millions of tons of e-waste a year with the connivance of the industrialized nations. The owners of these yards buy the waste abroad for peanuts, then recycle it using cheap labor. No money is spent treating the toxic leftovers or protecting the workers, so an item can be recycled for a tenth of the cost charged in Europe or the US. As opposed to the African dump sites, in Guiyu, there is a division of labor.
This is very typical local family workshop. The workers also recycle the plastic or CRT. This guy used the light to burn the plastic and classify different tests.
Separating different kinds of plastic by burning and smelling them is a cheap and effective technique, but it damages the lungs. Another family workshop specializes in recovering minute amounts of gold by dipping motherboards into acid baths. The workers are risking cancer by breathing in the toxic smoke. Afterwards, the remaining acid is simply dumped in the river. The groundwater has also been polluted, and even a simple cup of tea is laced with toxins. The constant exposure to substances such as PCBs, lead, and mercury is causing numerous health problems, including nerve and brain damage, skin diseases, and a rise in birth defects.
Really, what's happening is people are externalizing costs. You don't want to solve the problem, you'd rather let someone else deal with it, and you'll never have to pay for it. You don't ever get a bill from China saying, you contaminated my land, you have to pay.
China's factories in the neighboring provinces, for instance in Shanghai, Yangzhou, and Guangdong, immediately buy up any recycled materials, such as copper, aluminium, iron, gold, and plastics. But e-waste recycling is not only about selling scrap materials. An even more lucrative business is the recycling of computer chips. In clandestine workshops, transistors, integrated circuits, and other components are taken off discarded motherboards. The harvested parts are sorted and cleaned and sold as brand new components for the production of new electronics. This trade is said to be worth 100 billion euros a year, but it carries a huge risk that has an impact all over the globe, wherever computer chips are a part of our lives. For instance, in trains, planes, cars, nuclear power plants, hospitals, in short, everywhere. The companies who build the control systems for this kind of equipment are finding it increasingly difficult to distinguish between new chips and refurbished ones, and to be sure that their products, on which many lives depend, are safe. Since the original label has been painted over, it's hard to know which type of chip it really is. Clues pointing to the origin of a chip on the scrap heap are broken and missing pins, or labeling that has been scratched off with a crude and blunt instrument. If the chips were sold as new, they should have come from a factory like this facility in Dresden, where new chips are produced in a highly controlled environment. But the scratched surfaces point to a different origin. Guiyu, or another e-waste recycling village somewhere in the developing world. And this means that the chips might be damaged. Major chip manufacturers have started to employ investigators to keep tabs on the situation.
We're currently investigating a case where a customer had purchased from the open market a power module. They introduced them into a public transportation system, and after 1 month of usage, they exploded.
The module had burnt out inside. Stephen Jetta and his team found out that it had been fraudulently relabeled with a higher temperature resistance, probably because a high resistance fetches a better price.
You can imagine if you have a power module that's originally developed in an environment where maximum voltage is 1200 voltage, and it's been remarked in 2400 voltage, it's not going to last very long.
In this particular case, the passengers had a lucky escape.
We have no indication that anyone was injured in this incident, and we hope that remains the case.
TQ Systems have decided to check every single batch of chips on arrival using a special X-ray system. It will take time and effort to find out if the skewed connection is harmless or likely to cause a malfunction. Mike is back in Ghana and observing a steady stream of containers arriving from all over the world. Why do the Ghanaian authorities not seize the e-waste on arrival and only let in the functional second-hand goods? A young Ghanaian investigator, Anas Aramejo, has some answers. Anas always works undercover and has never shown his face in public. He recently took his hidden camera to Tema Harbor, Ghana's main port.
E-waste was one of the biggest areas that we looked into. For example, most fraud happened through the e-waste system. Customs have a form of valuation for such home appliances or goods, and the valuation is next to nothing. Somebody goes to clear used goods from the West, and they would look at it as condemned goods, so you're not going to pay the value that you would pay ordinarily.
At Tema Harbor, no one is really interested in separating working goods from waste. Everything is declared as waste and let in virtually tax-free, with the help of a bribe, or a little present for the customs officers.
Many of my footage, you see the SEPs officers walking through the e-waste. First of all, they themselves start picking some that they think is useful.
Then the importers sell the material. The working items go to the second-hand market, the rest to the scrap dealers. For the buyers, it's a gamble, as up to 90% can be broken or in need of repairs.
There was nothing like anybody's going to check the efficacy. In fact, at the sales point, you are told that this is it. It may have a fault or not. For example, if you take about 30 of them, the ones that will be working well will be about 2 or 3. But then the people who buy also rely on doing some repair work on it.
The items that work or can be repaired go on sale in the streets of Accra.
Majority of Ghanaians, about 90% of Ghanaians, would want to depend on the second-hand equipment. So there are new phones, there are new laptops, but it is still expensive and people don't have the money to afford these things.
The second-hand market is thriving. A functional 10-year-old computer siphoned off the recycling system in Europe or the US trades for 25 euros upwards. But there is a big problem with imported second-hand equipment. Often it has only a very short lifespan left.
We should control not only the waste, but the near end of life equipment, so things that become waste really quickly.
Ghana doesn't have any recycling facilities, so any equipment coming into the country, be it e-waste to be scrapped, new electronics, or second-hand imports, sooner or later ends up on a dump site like this. Ironically, many of the old appliances will have been officially charged to the recycling system in Europe before being exported. But the ones doing the actual recycling work are a group of kids who eke out a living selling the small amounts of metal they can recover. This can hardly be called efficient recycling. All this raises a seemingly naive question. Given that when we buy a new computer in Europe, its recycling is included in the purchase price, shouldn't this money end up with the person doing the actual recycling, wherever they may be on the planet? If European e-waste continues to go abroad, shouldn't the European recycling system be extended and used to set up modern recycling plants in places like Ghana? Or what about a totally different approach? While harbor controls failed to prevent the e-waste from entering, while broken electronics are traded freely on the internet, while e-waste travels the seas by the container load, while Europe and the US won't stop the ships from leaving, while recycling facilities in Europe are leaking like sieves to shady brokers, we need to remember who is at the start of the e-waste chain. The consumer. Few of us can resist the latest gadgets, and we have got into the habit of constantly replacing them with the latest model after a very short time. Last year, worldwide, nearly 50 million flat panel TV sets were sold, 300 million PCs, and 2 billion mobiles and smartphones. Sales figures for consumer electronics are constantly on the rise, and not only in Europe, but also in emerging markets such as India, China, and Africa. Maybe it's time to redefine our roles as consumers and start using our gadgets for a longer time, before the entire planet is littered with discarded appliances that have a long and toxic life ahead of them as e-waste.
The very first revolution that started with the people, continued with the people, did not change its word, did not change its way, did not decrease or increase its goals, is the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Ayatollah Khamenei.
The Limelight.
Since the attack on the United States Capitol building by a mob of loyalists to former President Donald Trump, tens of thousands of voters who were previously registered as members of the Republican Party have changed their affiliation away from the GOP. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Chris Walker, news writer. This article is published under the heading, At least 30,000 GOP voters have left the party since the Capitol breach. Here's the details of this article. Since the attack on the United States Capitol building by a mob of loyalists to former President Donald Trump 3 weeks ago, tens of thousands of voters who were previously registered as members of the Republican Party have changed their affiliation away from the GOP. The Hill reported recently that the departure of voters from the Republican Party is a virtually unprecedented exodus, as party affiliations don't typically change by that large a number unless there is a primary election for a different party that voters want to take part in. Around 30,000 voters have changed their allegiance away from the party, the publication reported. That's likely just a fraction of the true total, however, as the number represents just a few states that have reported on registration data since the events of January 6. The change in party affiliation does not necessarily benefit the other major political party in the U.S. Voters in Pennsylvania, for example, who opted to remove themselves from being registered Republicans, were two times more likely to join a third party or become unaffiliated with any party at all than they were to register as Democrats. Although thousands are leaving the GOP, those who are sticking with the party appear to have a forgive-and-forget attitude with regards to the attacks on the Capitol, particularly when it comes to their views on Trump. In surveys taken after the Capitol breach occurred, it had appeared that support for Trump within the party had waned, with only 42% of Republican respondents in a Political Morning Consult poll saying they wanted to see him run for president again in 2024. That number represented a decrease of 12 points compared to a poll that asked the same question in November, shortly after the presidential election. But polling recently from Morning Consult indicates that Trump is on a rebound with Republican voters. In a new poll released recently, 50% of Republican respondents say that Trump should play a major role in the GOP. A similar poll conducted by the organization on January 6th to 7th showed only 41% of respondents saying Trump should play a major role in the party. The Capitol breach is still on the minds of lawmakers in Congress, as the Senate is set to begin an impeachment trial against Trump for his role in instigating the attacks, while members of the House are involved in hearings over the slow response from the Capitol Police and other agencies on the day that it happened. Acting Chief of the Capitol Police, Eugenda Pittman, speaking to lawmakers recently about the Capitol breach, said that while the department was aware of a strong potential for violence, it had failed to take action to prepare for the possibility of an attack on Congress. Discussing those closed-door hearings with CNN, Representative Rosa DeLauro of Connecticut said that House members were shaking their heads in disbelief after hearing of how poorly agencies had planned for the attack. It was only by pure luck that elected officials, staffers, and more Capitol policemen were not killed. Representative Matt Cartwright from Pennsylvania also told The New York. The consequences from the violence of that day are still being felt, as a second Capitol Police officer has now died by suicide. According to CBS congressional reporter Zach Hodak, the officer in question was Jeffrey Smith, a 12-year member of the force. Recently, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez called for extending mental health services to Capitol support workers. It wasn't just members of Congress who were subjected to violence on January 6th, Ocasio-Cortez wrote in a tweet. Everyone at the Capitol that day experienced firsthand one of the most traumatic events in our nation's history. Support staff must have the same counseling and other resources as congressional staff.
Economic divide.
Hello, welcome to Economic Divide with me, Kavit Atway. For on this week's show, we will be looking at the situation in Britain that sees the children there going hungry as poverty strikes. Now, Britain prides itself as a modern, developed, and multicultural nation, claiming to have an excellent social service that's designed to maintain the needs and demands of its 66.5 million people. However, recent reports have painted a very different picture of the so-called land of hope and glory, as poverty kicks in harder than ever following the effect of the COVID-19 pandemic and more so, Brexit. Now, with around 25% of the population living in poverty and 4.5 million of them living in deep poverty, the most severely affected are the children, with Child Poverty Action Group showing that after housing costs have been calculated, just under 40% of British children live in poverty, according to IFS projections. Purple line here shows the after-housing costs. Now, taking the view on a broader scale, the End Hunger UK charity have published some truly alarming figures, suggesting that, for example, one in four parents have skipped a meal as they cannot afford to eat. Also, one in four parents worry about not having enough food to eat and feed their families, and one in eight people in Britain go a whole day without eating any food at all. Now that's around 8.3 million people based on the entire UK population. Well, let's now take a look at our first report, which covers a recent story emerging from Britain covering free school meals provided to underprivileged children in Britain, studying the less than impressive food packages that parents are expected to feed their children with.
Please, sir, I want some more.
What?
Please, sir, I want some more.
What's embarrassingly reminiscent of orphanages in Victorian times? British children are facing hunger on a scale not seen since Charles Dickens wrote about Oliver Twist in his famous novel. Yet here we are in 2021, and with Britain undergoing the toughest of times in its economic history as a direct result of the COVID-19 virus, and more worryingly, Brexit, the biggest victims of all the Tory government's failure are the children, with figures showing millions of them are now living in poverty in the towns and cities of Britain. With the country in its third lockdown, and figures showing that nearly 2,000 people are dying every day, the UK has had to react by closing down schools and learning facilities across the land. However, the problem does not lie in the children missing out on their education, as painful as that may seem. The biggest point is that for millions of British children, it means that they're missing out on their one square meal per day. As for those in poverty, food at home is nothing but a wishful dream. But it's not just the poorest families whose parents or guardians are out of employment.